coming in a few minutes later, a conference in which we briefly discussed the cases we're hearing today ran a bit later than usual. I want to start by welcoming two high school groups who are here with our national award-winning program that we run with the State Bar Court with Class. And we have Heritage Christian High School students. Would they please stand? Well, welcome to you. Please be seated. And now I may mispronounce the name. Is it Roncalli? Good. Roncalli High School students from Manitowoc. Would you please stand?
Christian Brothers. I went to a Christian Brothers.
Well, thank you very much. Well, and this morning we're going to have the Central Wisconsin Christian School from Waupun. And all of these groups will join with Justice Prosser after our second case and discuss the procedures of the court. Anyone in the courtroom or not in the courtroom who wishes to join the group at lunch time, you're all welcome. Now that the court has met you all, I would like to introduce the court to you. Starting on my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Next to him is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice Dave Prosser. So with those introductions made, we'll turn to our first case, 97-0994, King versus King. Ms. Felger, representing Sonia King.
May it please the court. Madam Chief Justice, other esteemed members of the court, Attorney Zabracki and Tikalski, and guests in attendance. Attorney Christina Felber of Dowling & Felber appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Sonia King, along with co-counsel, Attorney Paulette Dowling, also of Dowling & Felber. This court has asked to review this case on an independent basis pursuant to 809.62 Wisconsin statutes. The case before this court deals with the 7-year marriage of Dr. Christopher King, a neurosurgeon earning over $500,000 a year at the time of the divorce, and Sonia King, a homemaker without so much as a GED at the time of the divorce, which was tried in June of 1996 and ended by oral decision in October of 1996. Following 3 days of testimony by the trial court and written legal briefs submitted to the trial court by both parties, the trial court entered a decision as to all issues, paying particular attention to the maintenance award. The trial court, after going through every single factor of 767.26 Wisconsin statutes, made a reasoned decision to award maintenance of $450,000 to be paid out over a 3-year time period. The issues of maintenance and debt division were appealed to the Court of Appeals by Dr. King, and on April 1, 1998, the court issued its decision affirming that part of the trial court's decision dealing with debt division and reversing that portion of the decision dealing with maintenance. The Court of Appeals, in its decision, although properly citing erroneous exercise of discretion standards as the appropriate review, cited to the Weichel case, in which it states that maintenance shall be upheld in the sound discretion of the trial court unless there is a misuse of discretion, and further applied the Forrester case, which stated that the abuse of discretion would only be found with a misapplication of 767.26. It further stated that the trial court made complete findings under 767.26 Wisconsin statutes, and it never made a finding that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion as it relates to the maintenance award, although they did make a black and white finding that the court did not erroneously exercise its discretion as it relates to debt division. Rather than stating that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion, the appellate court cited the Girth case and the Luciani versus Montemurro-Luciani cases, in which both trial court decisions were upheld and therefore they are not relevant. The appellate court in this case went into their findings that Sonia was not entitled to maintenance based on basically a de novo standard of review. The appellate court simply applied post-judgment divorce cases to justify their reversal of maintenance. They stated as their grounds, first, Sonia's lack of initiative or effort to become self-supporting is a relevant factor for a court to consider in awarding maintenance. This statement is based on the Vanderparen case, which is a post-judgment case. Second, Dr. King's income is not attributable to Sonia's marital efforts. Again, this statement is based on the Johnson case, which is another post-judgment case, which was decided less than a month before the King case.
Why is it important that you make the distinction that it's a post-judgment case?
Justice, in the case that we are looking at here, the application of both the Johnson cases and the Vanderparen cases is relevant in the sense that what the Johnson case did was to make a ruling that fairness should not be a factor in determining maintenance awards. What they were looking at in that instance is what had happened between the time of the divorce and the time that we are going back in for this post-judgment modification. In those instances, fairness does become a factor when we're looking at that, but then you take that and you apply it back into the pre-judgment case, and it suddenly wipes out the fairness factor of the pre-judgment maintenance case, and therefore is not relevant. Third, there was no finding of need because according to the appellate court, the trial court found Sonia's budget to be worthless in determining maintenance. What the trial court actually stated is when the court sets maintenance on high-income cases, the court has to look at lifestyles. And this court, in reviewing the budget of Ms. King, does not find it helpful. However, based on case law, the court is simply not limited to what's in her budget or the terms that she sets forth. The Court of Appeals ruled that maintenance was not justified without ever making a finding that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion. The Court of Appeals, although citing relevant case law regarding erroneous exercise of discretion, never made a finding that the trial court, in fact, erroneously exercised that discretion. Rather, it simply determined that they didn't like the decision of the trial court and therefore reversed. This type of decision is indicative of de novo review, not erroneous exercise of discretion. The Court of Appeals erroneously made a finding of fact based on the record presented to them.
What was the fact, counsel?
They based their decision, Justice, on the fact that they didn't like it. They said that Ms. King was not justified, that an award of maintenance was not justified. They then went in to try to look at the facts, to go through the standards of 767.26, which the trial court had already done, and based on their reading, made a decision based on that, which pursuant to case law is not the way that it is to be done.
Well, according to case law, this is a review for erroneous exercise of discretion, right? So you have to look at the facts to see whether or not they don't hold up. And you have to look at the facts with the law. And it says in the Court of Appeals, and I'm looking at the appendix with the decision of the Court of Appeals at page, I think it's A62, it says, while the circuit court recognized that maintenance is to meet support and fairness objectives, it ignored that its findings as to the statutory factors all negate an entitlement to maintenance. So as I read that, it says, hey, the findings that the circuit court just didn't look at the fact that you don't need to have statutory, you don't have to have maintenance, and that the court didn't consider that.
Justice, that is not factually correct as to what happened. The trial court did go through each of the 10 steps of 767.26, made a finding based on every single one of those factors, came down to the end, which allows for any other factors to be taken into consideration, number 10, and in that made a decision based on fairness. Now, case law specifically states that the Court of Appeals must look first at whether the court applied its discretion properly, using the Forrester case, using the Weichel case. By the Forrester case standards, The court did what it was supposed to do. It went through every single factor, made a ruling based on every single factor, came down and based on its factors, found that fairness played a factor in this and needed to be taken into consideration, and based on that made a ruling.
Well, what does fairness mean in this case?
Fairness is dealing with the equitable doctrine that was employed by the LaRoe case. And in that, they are looking at what is fair and just under the circumstances. And what we're looking at really in this case is, can society look at a marriage?
You're asking, this is the LaRoe case, is it?
When we look at the actual case before us, the King case, what we are looking at is...
I didn't mean to interrupt, but you said LaRoe, and I was thinking... Automatically, you meant when you were talking about LaRoe versus LaRoe?
Right.
Okay.
That's correct. When we're looking at the King case, the factors of the King case, what we're looking at is, can society look at the fact that we have a marriage that was entered into willingly by both parties, that was enjoyed by both parties for a number of years, and now we have the husband walking away with over $500,000 worth of income, and his wife walking away with nothing. That's where we're looking at fairness. Is that fair?
Well, it's a 6-7 year marriage, right?
Correct.
What property did she bring into the marriage?
Very little, but neither did he.
Okay, so at that time, neither one of them had property?
Correct.
So the assets were accumulated at the 7 years?
Correct.
And she also brought into the family 4 children, and there were no children?
That's correct.
And, as a result of the divorce, there was a property division?
Correct.
And how much did she get?
They each received about $250,000 worth of assets.
So there was an accumulation of about $500,000 in the 7 years?
Correct.
And she got half of that?
Yes.
So she contributed to getting this $500,000? I assume that's your argument.
Correct.
And she got that. Okay. Now, why would she get maintenance?
Again, looking back at the fairness factor and going through those factors of 767, she made it possible for Dr. King to go out and earn his income. She was there to provide for the services necessary for him to go out and do that.
The record at least would indicate that that's not completely accurate, that in fact the doctor did a lot of cooking, brought home a lot of meals, that the kind of homemaking that one would have anticipated was not, at least that's what how I read the record, the kind of homemaking that you're talking about was really not all that present in this book.
And that would be based on the testimony of Dr. King as opposed to the testimony of Ms. King. But there's also a lot more to providing for needs than are just in cooking.
My question is, I think, a bit attenuated onto the others as far as, so there was a 7-year marriage, and she received basically 50% of the accumulation. Now the marriage is over, and the maintenance is coming out of the income that he is going to earn, supposedly, or hypothetically, for the next 3 years, because it's, as I recall, it's $200,000, $150,000, and maybe $100 split that way.
Correct.
And that's my question now. Understanding there was an equitable division, there was a short time marriage, but now the fairness doctrine you're saying is to take money from his earnings for the next several years.
Correct.
Yes.
As is in any maintenance award. Yes, that's correct.
But it has to do with the initial short-term marriage and the property division also.
I'm sorry.
I'm just saying that there was a property division which was 50-50.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, if I can get the facts straight again, I saw it in some brief. Didn't this $500,000 a year income really only begin like in the final year of their marriage? Wasn't there a gradation where, I've got it. He started off, actually, when they started off, they weren't getting much money at all, right? They were both, what's that?
Careful.
And then his income was $40,000 per year prior to working for Neurologic Associates in Washington, and then his income began to go up. And in 1992, it got to $200,000, and then in increments thereafter.
Correct. And again, Justice, these are facts that were all tried to the court, and the court took all of these facts into consideration.
But maintenance, for instance, maintenance for the first year was essentially one half of his highest income earning year. Is that correct?
Approximately, yes.
Ms. Felber, there seemed to be a lot of emphasis in the trial court's decision to maintaining lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's appropriate? Do you think that's an appropriate factor under the statute?
Under the statute, it is to be considered in as one of the factors. And the court did come back and state that Sonia could not maintain the type of lifestyle that she had been living at, but that she needed a chance to be able to get out and get back up on her feet again. One of the things that we need to take into consideration is this woman lost 7 years of her life. She lost 7 years worth of her prime time to be getting an education and her prime time to be getting the fundamentals of a career.
Does the record reflect any effort on her part to improve education, to improve her job skills? Was there anything that shows that she had plans to do that during the three-year period of maintenance?
Justice, the record actually reflects that Dr. King not only dissuaded her from working, but ridiculed her from trying to go out and get a job, and basically said to her, look, I can make more money in one night than you can in a month. It was his intention to keep her at home. It was his intention.
But I'm asking about plans during that three-year period where maintenance was being granted. Is there any testimony that she had definite plans, for instance, to go back to school, get her GED, get a high school diploma, improve her job skills in any way during that three-year period?
During the three-year period that she was actually receiving the maintenance?
Right.
Yes, Justice, there was testimony based on the fact that she did intend to go and get her GED, and obviously she was going to have to go and get herself into a career. She had no choice.
Wasn't there something also in the record that she had been instructed by the court during the pendency of the divorce to make efforts to obtain employment, and she made no such efforts?
Justice, there was a requirement that she did obtain income. She did make efforts to obtain that income by trying to go back and get her GED. There was considerable testimony taken on her efforts to obtain that GED and the problems she faced with ADD and dyslexia. Furthermore, an income was imputed to Ms. King as a result of this.
In the petition for review on A54, the court characterizes this high maintenance award is appropriate, and then he says, even though Mrs. King's lifestyle is one in which she seems to choose to exercise irresponsibly rather than responsibility. It's kind of, a curious statement, and then to go ahead and make that award.
Again, Justice, this was something that the court considered as a whole. Again, this was 3 days worth of testimony with a number of witnesses that were testifying, and based on the full testimony, made that decision in light of the statements that he was making, and in addition to the statements that he was making, he still believed that maintenance was reasonable under the circumstances.
Well, then he finished up that she legally has the right to expect maintenance, to demand maintenance, and is entitled to it. That, I just, as though it's sort of a conclusion that even though there's irresponsibility, that she would be entitled to maintenance because of the, quote, 7-year marriage.
Justice, I think that when people marry each other, they know what they're getting into when they get married. And I believe that that's part of what the court was taking into consideration. Both of them entered into a marriage contract, both of them knowing who the other person was. And with that full knowledge in mind, this is where they end up at the point of the divorce.
What were the ages of the children at the time of the divorce?
They were all late teenagers, I believe between the ages of about 12 and 17. Counsel,
looking at the Court of Appeals opinion, the per curiam opinion, it seems that how you define contribution in marriage might be a real nutshell of this case. The chief quoted from page, A6, while the circuit court, from the opinion, while the circuit court recognized that maintenance is to meet support and fairness objectives, the Court of Appeals found it ignored that its findings as to the statutory factors all negate entitlement to maintenance. Now, what did the Court of Appeals mean by that? It went on and said this: not one of the statutory factors relevant to this case suggest that Sonia made any contribution to the partnership entitling her to maintenance. Two sentences later, they reiterate, there is no law that a spouse is entitled... There is no law that a spouse is entitled to take from the marriage without making a contribution to the marriage, and then continue to share in a payer's spouse's high earnings with when the marriage ends. So it's this focus, it seems to me, and indeed in your opposing counsel's brief, it is their number one argument, that no contribution was made to the marriage.
And Justice, that is the very reason that we are here today. Because it is that decision by the Court of Appeals, their decision which supplants the decision of the trial court, which they are making a decision based on a reading of the transcript, supplanted their decision for the trial court after hearing all of the factors.
I mean, that's why I focus on that. That seems to be the finding that the Court of Appeals makes here, that there is no evidence of any contribution to the partnership entitling her to maintenance. And then the next sentence that I read. So it seems to me the Court of Appeals' opinion is saying that if there isn't evidence that she helped him in his career in terms of helping him get his degree or helping him in the social things that may be anticipated, I know there are testimony about that, that's how you define contribution. How do you define contribution to a marriage?
Well, Justice, the way that they define contribution is that they went on to cite both this Vanderparen case and this Johnson case, and they define contribution by economic means. They said, Sonia's lack of initiative or effort to become self-supporting is a relative factor. They also said, Dr. King's income is not attributable to Sonia's marital efforts. They define contribution based solely on her financial needs. And again, they took their opinion and they supplanted it with the trial court's decision after hearing all the factors.
Suppose, for argument's sake, that I have a husband that adores me.
Congratulations.
Is that, that stops that.
That's the end of my question.
Is that, do you think, a contribution in a marriage with someone who adores and then comes with what comes with adoring, helping, attending to the needs, taking care of the emotional, the physical needs? Is that a contribution to the marriage?
Absolutely. If your husband adores you and makes it possible for you to walk into this courtroom every single day and feel good about yourself, and be able to do your job instead of going home every night going, okay, I have to go home and have my fight after I've made his dinner and cleaned his socks. Absolutely. That is a contribution.
Even though it is not as tangibly economic as others? I mean, how do you define contribution in a marriage?
You leave it up to the trial court. That's their job, is to define that, what that role is. And in this case, the trial court did this. This is... The way that the trial court did this is a textbook example of the proper use of discretion. They did exactly what they were supposed to do, and they did it, and now the Court of Appeals is coming back and saying no.
I have another question. Seems to me that when you get married, you agree to financially support, as well as support in other ways, your spouse. Now it didn't work out and you're getting divorced. Is there anything in the cases or statute that would indicate that where you have somebody who might very well be destitute, it's not the case necessarily here because she has $250,000, that it's an obligation of the spouse, the former spouse, to continue support because it should be the spouse's obligation rather than the state's?
Yes. There is a public policy that states that the state should not be responsible to support someone when there is someone available to do that support.
Okay, and now my next question is, I read the Court of Appeals decision carefully. What's the result? That she gets zero maintenance forever?
That's the result of the Court of Appeals
decision.
They didn't
remand it.
They did not remand. They flat out reversed.
And so they exercised, the Court of Appeals exercised its discretion rather than send it back to the trial court, because the Court of Appeals apparently made a conclusion of law that she is not entitled.
They said she is not justified.
Mm-hmm.
Which they can't do, I take it.
Excuse me?
I assume they can do it if they believe that the record can be read no other way.
If they believe that a misuse of discretion is there, absolutely they have the right to do that, but they never found there was an erroneous exercise of discretion. It is not there. It is not there hidden. It is not there blatant.
Well, and what was the demand of the husband at trial? Did he want zero, or did he want less than the trial court gave?
Zero.
Now, do you believe, is there any law that would say that with respect to transition funds, because this strikes me as more of a transitional case.
Are you talking in terms of like rehabilitative maintenance?
Limited
term maintenance, but put another word, transitional, to allow someone to settle down more gently.
Right. I believe that is what happened here, yes.
But what law supports that?
There is a whole body of law that is out there that talks in terms of what a court can or cannot do as far as setting limited terms of maintenance on it. But I think one of the telltale cases on this is this Luciani Matamura case, and dealing with the Court of Appeals decision, not the Supreme Court decision. But in the Luciani Matamura case, we're looking at a very similar set of facts. We are looking at maintenance that was set for a 36-month time period. We are looking at maintenance that was set at, when you look at the respective incomes, you're looking at maintenance that was set in about the same kind of percentages as was in the Luciani Matamura case. And in that case, the Court of Appeals said, yes, it's justified.
And that was not looked at by this court, was it, in the appeal?
No, the issue of maintenance was not reviewed by the Supreme Court.
Justice Prosser has a question.
In 5 years, if you win this case, what do you want King versus King to stand for?
In 5 years, what I want King versus King to stand for is a reaffirmation that we must take into consideration all of the factors of 767.26, that we must continue to uphold the dual objectives of LaRocque and its dual objectives of the support factor and the fairness factor. I want more than anything else to make sure that the ruling in the Johnson case is not applied to this case, because in doing that, I really am fearful of what happens with the rest of our maintenance cases. I'm really fearful that what we're going to end up with is a situation where you end up with an entire group of attorneys that are saying, we don't have to consider fairness anymore. King says. That's what I want.
Is this limited to 3 years?
Yes, it is.
I know it's limited to 3 years, but at the end of a third year, can they come back?
Trial court doesn't have the ability to put on a non-modifiable on it, so yes, it is modifiable.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Tchaikovsky, representing Christopher King.
Good morning, Justices. Thank you for the privilege of appearing here. My name is Stephen Tchaikovsky from the firm of Tchaikovsky, Rosh & Tchaikovsky in Waukesha, and I represent, as it relates to this appeal, the respondent Christopher King. This case has a clear erroneous exercise of discretion by the trial court. And the appellate court, when it made their initial review and decision, made that very, very clear. You are now looking at this under a standard of review of de novo. The discretion that was used misapplied the law, and that gives you the opportunity to look at this as a legal issue. We're not here to look at facts and change facts. We're looking at strictly the law. Dr. King contends now, as he has through the whole case, that maintenance is not appropriate in this matter. What I will do during my time is try to set out for you the areas of law that need to be looked at, some of the facts that we need to consider, and then try to directly apply those factors. The first thing we need to look at when we look at maintenance is going back to 1977, when the legislature went forward and changed our divorce law. The maintenance law that we have now is based on that change which went into effect in 1978. And the legislature laid out very clearly the intent for this part of the law. And it said that a spouse that is handicapped either socially or economically by contributions to a marriage would be entitled to some compensation or education, and as the court had indicated, to somewhat soften the blow and lower or more comfortably. In using that intent, that if there was a handicap as a result of a contribution, we have 10 specific factors. Actually, 9 specific factors and a 10th factor that is broad, bringing in other relevant matters. The courts, in reviewing this over the years, has looked at this, and primarily in the LaRock decision, has set up a fairness and support objective to help interpret and move that forward. This court has used that and very clearly set out the standards for maintenance and how it should be dealt with in long-term marriages. There is essentially no law that would help us in short-term marriage like this one. And when I say like this one, I'm saying a short-term marriage where there was, as the court in its trial court decision said, essentially no contribution to the marriage by the spouse requesting maintenance, and a spouse that was not handicapped by the marriage, did not lose any.
How do you define contribution?
As you were asking that, when I look at contribution, it covers a variety of things. Obviously, financial is the easiest one to see, but that certainly is not the only factor. The support, the assistance that is given during a marriage, in a normal marriage, which I don't think this fit into very well, we may have the wife who is home as here, who would do the husband's laundry, cook the meals, possibly, as we saw in a number of the cases where there was a medical degree, in Roberto and in Luciani, where the wife worked and supported the husband so he could get his medical degree.
As I understood the facts in this case, there was no employed outside cook, outside person to do the laundry, no employed housekeeper, so it fell to the responsibility of those in the house. Is that correct?
Your statement of fell to those in the house is correct. It did not, in this case, land on Sonia King. The testimony and the record shows clearly that Dr. King, through the whole marriage, did his own laundry.
Counsel, it appears to me, and I might be wrong, but it appears to me that in looking at the transcript and parts of the record, that there's really a contest of issues as to, you know, who did how much. I mean, I'm not sure that you can say the record is clear unless you only read some of their pages. Is that a fair...
I am reading the record, noting that there was some conflict. Some areas were quite clear that Dr. King...
I mean, the response on the other side, as I understood it, was, look, he's a neurosurgeon making $533,000 a year and has been on call a lot, and so sometimes he's gone in the evenings. And that's understatement. The reply was he was gone lots, you know, that she was home. I mean, that's the other side of the story. I'm not saying it's totally accurate. I'm just saying there are two sides of the story here. And I'm trying to be fair about that. And there's a dispute. Is that correct?
Well, there is a dispute, but you need then to take one step further. And when you look at Judge Hawney's findings in his long oral decision, that's where it kind of crystallizes. And the statements that Judge Hawney made were really startling as to the credibility of Mrs. King and her friends that testified.
That went to property division, if I recall correctly. With regard to maintenance on pages 28 and 29 of the appendix, he gives the reason, after going through the factors, he gives the bottom line reason for his maintenance determination, as I recall. What do you understand those reasons to be?
Your Honor, I have to say I'm confused and startled by him. When I listened to the decision and I heard everything that he was saying and going through all of the facts and the findings, I honestly was dumbfounded when he made his statement on maintenance.
I remember, well, rather than what your response is, what do you understand the basis of his decision to be? If you have an understanding, do you have an understanding?
The best I understand is that he feels that someone that earns a lot of money should be paying additional support. And when I combine that with the law, I feel that your trial court missed the function of contribution, because he very clearly showed that she had no significant contribution to the marriage in supporting him. In fact, she did all she could to detract from his ability to earn. One of the examples that the trial court specifically noted was that one night when he was on call, she made 100 calls to his answering service. He needs to respond to that. That affects him. That detracts from his ability to work and function and grow.
Maybe this will refresh your recollection. On page 28, going into page 9, he says, as the basis, when a married, well, he talks about they choose each other. Unlike some other situations where business partners may be split up and left with no obligations, or where some roommates may be split up and left with no obligations, when a marriage is split up, people are left with financial obligations and obligations under the law to support other party, including a lifestyle that they have become accustomed to, period, paragraph. Is that your understanding of what he articulated as the basis for his opinion on maintenance?
I think that's the only basis that he had, but that does not fit well with the case law that we have to date.
But Mr. Tucholsky, I'm reading from page 54, A54 of the trial court's decision, and in the last paragraph, he states, he seems to be stating it as a matter of law. It does not change the fact that when two people choose to marry each other, that their incomes become divided up, and that she legally has the right to expect maintenance, to demand it, and is entitled to it. Is that a correct statement of the law?
No, Your Honor, that is not a correct statement of the law. There is no absolute entitlement. I think if you look at the cases that are out in the law, we can look at Girth, which I believe was cited by the appellate court. In that case, it reminded us that, in fairness, there has to be some partnership. A concept of a partnership in a marriage, which we all expect and we all assume, but in this case, when we look at the facts, that partnership was not really in existence in the way that we would normally see it in a marriage, even one that fails as this one did. The court showed that, and showed that there needs to be that assistance. That's what we don't have here.
Was there any evidence in the record about, and one of the things that is interesting to me is just the time that it takes to run a household of four kids of that those ages. Was there any, and I think of, I mean, myself, you know, we have a housekeeper that just takes care of the laundry and cleaning the house, and we employ 20 hours a week, and she still doesn't get it done. And she's fast and good. I mean, the number of hours that it takes to run a house with four children and attend to things, is that considered as contribution in a marriage?
The problem that we have with that question in this case, Your Honor, is the four children were not a product of this marriage. Those were her children from a prior marriage. She was spending her time, which Dr. King was able to allow her to do by the opportunities that he made for himself before the marriage, the extensive education and training. There was no education and training change during the marriage because of what he had done before they were a partnership.
I don't know this because people view things differently. I don't know what the record says. But I think that some people would be delighted to have a ready-made family of four children. others would be feel burdened by it, you know. I don't know what the facts are here. I do know that he wanted step-parent visitation, and that's a whole other issue. But to discount the kids and say they're hers, I mean, maybe that was a contribution to the marriage. In my marriage, it would be. I'd love it. And I don't know what had happened here.
I don't think that the facts in the trial court are specific enough to determine that. Yes, when he came in, he cared for those children and was very generous. But the obligation for him was not the same as the obligation for her. So she had to spend 3 or 4 children, and I know how much work that is. But that is not something that Dr. King needs to be responsible for, and the law can't impose that.
He knew those burdens, however, when they got married.
Certainly. At least he had the perception that a single person would have as to marriage and children, which okay. I'm not sure you ever have a complete understanding, Justice.
Mr. Tchaikovsky, what would Ms. King need per year to maintain a reasonable standard of living? Maybe not the highest that was at the end of their marriage, but somewhere in between. I mean, is there a budget in here that tells us that?
Your Honor, the budget that is in the record, as Judge Haney clearly stated, really was of no assistance. They went through and showed that many of the expenses were really attributed to the children. The other ones he didn't believe. He made comments that the budget, her lifestyle was not responsible and Dr. King shouldn't support it. So when I tried to then dream up a budget, which is the only thing that we have because there are no facts in the record that give us a budget, we need to look at that. She was given, as was discussed earlier, a substantial property division,
right,
approximately $250,000. If that kind of money is used sensibly, she would have a very good foundation to move forward. And if she would have pursued some educational interests, she did not. The record is very clear that she was given the opportunity and encouraged to go through and get her high school equivalency diploma, which she didn't do. She chose Oprah Winfrey instead, as the trial court said. I go one step further in looking at those types of opportunities, and when the court instructed her to do a work search, she chose not to. And when we look at the cases, it's quite clear from Vanderparen is one example, that you have to make some effort. If she made some effort and used the abilities that she had and then took advantage of the extensive property division, she would be able to support herself and support her children to some extent as well.
Which, of course, is not Dr. King's obligation.
Correct.
All right. Well, if you take $250,000 and you had it straight cash and you invested it at 7%, you'd get about $17,500. Think that would be a reasonable maintenance?
Well, if she then, on top of that, uses her own efforts,
she could make $660,000, according to him. That's how much.
$13,000 to $15,000. She is then making almost as much as Dr. King was making when he was first working. So, yes, that is a substantial amount of money that provides for her, especially when we look at the fairness objective and the support objectives that are set out in the ROC and defined as to what fairness is requiring something be contributed.
Let's take a look at that, because I think this is an important component of this case. People are talking about fairness and support as being the two objectives of maintenance. Lorac, of course, is a long-term marriage. What are the objectives of limited-term maintenance?
Well, if I go back to the intent of the legislature, I have to interpret that as one of the ways that we look at it. Long-term marriages obviously are very different, and that's where all of our case law, substantially all of our case law is. The intent of the legislature was to have maintenance be available for someone who was socially or economically handicapped by a contribution to the marriage.
But what do our cases say, if at all? Well, let me be specific. Doesn't Locke say that the purpose, that limited-term maintenance has many purposes, and we do not enumerate all of them? It can provide a recipient spouse with funds for training. It may be an incentive to seek employment. It limits the responsibility of the payor to a certain time and thus avoids a future relationship between the parties in litigation relating to modifications. It has many purposes. Is transition of lifestyle one of the many limited purposes that were set forth in our language in Lorac?
Well, I would look to specifically the Girth decision, which looked more at that than the broad concepts that Lorac sets out. And Girth was a 20-year marriage, and it found that the wife should receive no maintenance.
I'm talking about limited term, you know, because this is unique. We have all these long-term marriages. Lorac's, although deals with long-term, and of course everyone says support and fairness are the two issues of basis purposes of maintenance, but there are, in limited maintenance cases, other purposes. My question to you is, transition in lifestyle a purpose of limited maintenance?
I think that the court could look at limited maintenance as a transition opportunity, but in this case, a substantial property division really fulfills that provision.
Okay, but my question, I just want to know, because if it is a purpose, and then you can argue whether or not the purpose is fulfilled, but is transition in lifestyle a purpose of limited maintenance?
I could not cite a case that specifically says it is, but I see that the court could interpret it that way. They haven't to this date, as far as I recall reading the cases.
Is it correct, as other counsel stated, that with a decision from the Court of Appeals, in effect, this woman will receive nothing in maintenance?
That is correct. The decision of the trial court, the appellate court found, was so erroneous and so clearly erroneous that it was able to make that decision, and it was not necessary to remand for any other facts or any other action.
So because of a trial judge's error, she'll be denied any maintenance if there was an error?
She's not being denied maintenance because of the trial court's error. She's being denied maintenance because of the laws of the state of Wisconsin, the intent that the legislature set out, and the specific facts that fit this case. She is being denied maintenance because she is not entitled to it under the law as stated by the legislature and by the courts in their decisions.
Well, what is the court's authority to fashion something between zero and $450,000 over 3 years? Mm-hmm. Or is it?
I don't think that based on the status that the court is in a position to fashion, because there may not be the facts that would allow that review. I think that the court has the facts here that clearly say that there was an erroneous use of discretion by the trial court, that the error of Judge Haughty was substantial, and that we really need to go with the appellate court's review. The court obviously has discretion to do most anything it chooses.
I'm not sure I understand your answer. Is it $450,000 or nothing for this court?
I believe the court, because it's a de novo review, could interpret the law and make other decisions, but I don't believe that would be correct decision based on the facts and the law. I mean that the court making a decision of law would be looking at giving no maintenance.
Could I ask you one other question? If the trial court's position were to be upheld, what freedom does Dr. King have to pursue a change in lifestyle? For example, would he be able to join the Peace Corps?
Those are always very difficult issues, because under the decision of the trial court, he has an obligation to pay these very high dollar maintenance amounts. And the trial court in case law would have the ability to impose upon him an ability to pay whether he chose to work or not. If he suddenly said, I'm sick of this, I'm quitting work, I'm going to become a bum, the court could impose upon him an obligation because he has the earning ability, and then enforce him to pay or be in contempt of court. This amount of maintenance certainly has to influence him in being forced to continue doing something, whether he chooses that as his best option for life and for contribution to society or not. The trial court could review it upon a change of circumstances and modify it. It would not have to.
Did I understand Counsel Felber to say that after 3 years, assuming the maintenance were continued, that it could be renewed?
Because the trial court does not have the authority to put a very absolute finite time frame on maintenance, any time during that period of maintenance, Sonia King could come back to the trial court and ask for it to be modified or extended. So one day before the 3 years, she could file a motion and ask the trial court, saying, I still can't live, I have not become self-supporting, or whatever the factors may be, give me more. That would be absolutely inappropriate, even more so inappropriate than where we are today, which I feel is not correct.
Now, when we're reviewing this case, we're like the Court of Appeals, and we're reviewing an exercise of discretion, right?
Correct.
And we can say it's just terrific, no problem. Or even if we disagree with it, it's within the reasonable range. Or we can say there's been an erroneous exercise of discretion. And that's what the Court of Appeals said, or can be interpreted to have said. Now, then the Court of Appeals would seem to me have two alternatives. It could send it back to the trial court to exercise its discretion.
That's correct.
Or the Court of Appeals could exercise discretion itself.
It does have the authority to exercise its own discretion based on its review of erroneous exercise by the trial court.
And that's what it did in this case. It exercised its own discretion and said zero.
Correct.
Okay. Just checking.
When we look at this case and we sort through very particularly the factors that the courts need to look at based on the statute for maintenance, as we walk through them, just as the trial court did and as the appellate court noted, the factors do not support maintenance. We have a short-term marriage. We have a marriage where Dr. King, as the court found, was healthy, but Mrs. King did all she could to detract from his emotional health. The court, Attorney Felber indicated, she mentioned some dyslexia and some issues of learning disabilities, but the court specifically in its decision did not find those to be correct. The court found that she was not being responsible. As we walk through the factors, we find that we haven't had any education or training changes that would encourage maintenance. We go to the next factor and we look at agreements that they had. There were no specific agreements. There are no tax consequences. We don't have any change except that under the facts, each of them have had a change in their actual earnings, or as Sonia King, her earning capacity has changed. But none of that is based on contributions or specific actions of the other party. And as we walk through the cases, we look at that, and the only thing that we have here was a very fortunate transition in time that brought an income change to Dr. King. That income change for Dr. King was as a result of all the work and training and education he had before the marriage. None of that was a contribution and assistance during that marriage time.
Let me tell you one of my concerns with the Court of Appeals opinion, and that is defining and emphasizing contribution to a marriage on economics. And the paragraph that I read earlier that emphasized no contribution, she made no contribution to the marriage, and then went out to spell economic reasons, just seems to me to fly in the face of all of the people, men and women, who decide that they don't, you know, want to go out in the workforce, and that the couples decide this is a unit. You know, this is a partnership. This is their, if you will, arrangement. And it seems to me that it's almost a return to those not so thrilling days of yesteryear, when the contributions, non-economic, of a homemaker were considered unimportant. And I'm really bothered by that.
The appellate court did use the factors of financial as a main focus. But we need to look further, as you're saying, into what went on in the marriage. And the facts in the record show that there was not the kind of contribution emotionally that you would expect, as you said, for house cleaning and things of that sort. Certainly, someone did that. The record shows that each of the children were asked to do jobs.
Give me a break.
That's what the record shows.
Well, it shows both ways. That's what I pointed out before. It shows both ways, right?
There is testimony, but I believe that when you look carefully at the testimony, it's clear that Dr. King did his own laundry, and that I would expect in a normal marriage would be something that was be done by the person that was staying home when they did not have an outside employment. That didn't happen here. He did many of the things, as the record shows, that you would expect the person at home to do. This marriage never quite gelled as a true partnership where one hand was reaching out to support the other. The one hand was of Sonia King, I believe, was slapping the other hand and beating it down because the things that she was doing were detracting, were affecting his ability to continue to move forward and support her and stay emotionally and physically healthy.
Such as?
The most horrendous example that Judge Haney cited was making 100 phone calls to him when he was on call.
But was that during the pendency of the marriage or during the pendency of the divorce?
I believe that was during the pendency of the divorce, Your Honor.
But what about during the Justice Bradley's questions go to, and it's a legitimate concern, the kind of emotional contributions that one normally finds in a marriage, whether it's short-term or long-term. What factors mitigate against that position?
There, I don't believe in the record, is any real clear information as to that, in effect, emotional contribution, other than when we talk about the laundry and the meals and the cleaning, which there's testimony not favorable to Mrs. King throughout all of those. There isn't really clear testimony about her ever having done anything to encourage and emotionally support. The only thing that comes to mind is the statement that was made about moving to Waukesha when they made the decision to come here and actually move into the private practice after the residency part. And the trial court found that she was a very minor factor in that decision.
Well, are we able to make any judgments about her contributions during the course of her marriage? The kind of emotional contributions and support contributions Justice Bradley is correctly referring to. From the behavior of Mrs. King during the pendency of the divorce?
I believe that you can look at the pendency of the divorce. Certainly emotions are much higher there, but the character of a person doesn't fundamentally change. You may be a little bit more tense during the pendency of a divorce action, which I would expect in most cases. And when we look at the pendency, which is really where we have the clear facts, her character is coming through clearly. She was destroying his property. She was doing everything she could to destroy him and did nothing to even be neutral. And if she had the tendency to be very helpful during the marriage, I would hope that she could at least, through much of the pendency, remain somewhat neutral rather than destructive. It shows that it never gelled as a partnership where one party was contributing to the other. Your Honor, I think when we look at this case closely, we need to be conscious that what you are doing here is making public policy. Public policy from this court is going to be around for a long time and be looked to. It would be bad public policy for this court to award maintenance under the facts of this type of a case. We can't be rewarding someone who has not joined in that partnership that the other case law talks about, that has not gone forward to assist. We go through the legislative intent. That intent does not provide any reason for maintenance. There was not an economic or social handicap, and there was not the contribution, whether financially or emotionally, available. The factors in the statute, as the trial court decision shows, and the appellate court clearly said, are not there. There is nothing supporting the encouragement of maintenance. And when we look at fairness and support and really go into those factors as to what fairness means, the partnership, the contribution, the property division, which was extensive, none of those provide a reason for this court to provide maintenance. And when we look forward at what this will say in the future, we need to let people know that what they are doing in a marriage is joining together. And if you have worked together, you will have the right to receive some assistance, something for that.
Okay.
We don't have that in these facts.
Thank you, Mr. Pedoff.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Felber?
I want to start out by begging to differ with my esteemed opposing counsel here. He said that characters do not change as part of a divorce. You know, that unfortunately is just not true. We see school teachers who suddenly pick up guns and point them at their own heads. We see very level-headed people who suddenly do very, very irrational things during a divorce. Attorney Tucholsky is asking you, as they were asking the trial court, to look at the things that happened during the divorce and apply that to the entire marriage. The trial court had the opportunity to do that, and they chose not to. When Dr. King married Sonia, he was fully aware of her educational and career history and her four children. He did not encourage her to do anything to further their bottom line and dissuaded it and patronized her for it. And yet, 7 years after he marries her, he divorces her, and not only does he feel that he owes her nothing, the Court of Appeals agrees with him. Because she's done nothing to improve herself during the marriage. This is blatantly unfair and contrary to the well-established law. The appellate court simply did not want Sonia to receive maintenance. They didn't feel she was justified.
Well, Ms. Counsel, just taking her behavior during marriage, you just said she did nothing to improve herself during the course of the marriage.
This is what the Court of Appeals stated.
Oh, was that a finding of the trial court?
That was not a finding of the trial court. That was a finding of the Court of Appeals.
Let's assume that that you can glean it from the record. Just let me get the thought on it.
Okay.
Can we take, assuming that to be true,